We're going to think about this marvelous story of the woman who, out of that vast crowd, touched Jesus Christ. And in a sense, the message of this lady, wifey, I like to call her, this wifey, lies in the scene. And if you can get the picture, then you get the message. This is a miracle inside a miracle, because the Jairus part of it starts, you see, over here, and it is while Christ is en route for the house of Jairus that the lady comes into the picture. And so you've got the start of a miracle here and the end of the miracle there, and in between, sandwiched between those two incidents, Jairus appealing for help and the wee girl of 12 being raised from the dead, you've got this story of the lady with the hemorrhage who touched the fringe of Christ's robe. It's a miracle in a miracle. Now, if you see this picture, the first thing you notice is what a difference there is between the two characters. Jairus is a ruler of the synagogue. That's to say, he's quite rich, he's quite well-to-do, he could afford servants, he could afford professional mourners. You had to pay the fee to get them to come in and ululate, howl, the Eastern howl that you hear even from Arabs today. You heard Arabs ululating in Lawrence of Arabia, that marvelous scene when he's riding out on the camel, you see, to do battle with the Turks, and all round the hills you see the Arab women, and they're all ululating, a beating sound. And that's the sound that professional mourners make. Now they have to get money, you see, for their services. And so here is this rich man, the ruler of the synagogue, very churchy and respectable, and here is a woman who couldn't enter the church at all, because the law of God said that anyone with a hemorrhage could not enter the congregation of God's saints, because a hemorrhage was something that made you unclean. And it didn't matter whether you were a man or a woman, you were reckoned to be impure and almost untouchable. So the difference, you see, between Jairus and the woman is that he's away up there and she's away down here. He's rich, and she's very poor, because she's spent all her money going round these useless medicos with her quack cures, the mountebanks, the charlatans of the day. And here she is, and she's been draining away for 12 years. Jairus's daughter is also 12. You see, there are two 12s in this story. There's the lassie growing up, 12 years, full of life, nice home, rich home, good education, respected father, 12 years, a lot to look forward to, and then out she goes. During those 12 years, while the girl is living, the woman's dying. She's draining away. And she can't get into God's house to ask for help, because she's unclean. And the one thing they have is their need of Jesus. There is no difference between the need of Jairus and the need of the wifey. You see, it's not just death that is the great leveler of men. When we die, we're all brought down to the same level. Winston Churchill, mighty men, they are brought down and they are leveled in death. But the other thing that levels us and puts us all on the same level is our need of Christ. And the depth, you see, of the woman's need is seen in the fact that she was bleeding. You see, the Jews had a fear of issues. In fact, there are chapters of the Old Testament that give all the things that are to be done and all the procedures that are to be observed if somebody is suffering from an issue. If there's a running sore, or a septic wound, or a hemorrhage, above all other things, a hemorrhage, then it was surrounded with all sorts of taboos. Maybe it was because the Jews didn't really understand what was happening. You see, we're all afraid. We're all afraid of things we don't understand. Children are afraid of the dark, because they don't understand it. A savage is afraid when there's an eclipse and everything goes dark and the birds stop singing. It goes quiet if you've ever been through an eclipse, a rather strange, eerie experience. And savages who don't understand what's happening up in the sky are afraid. And so the Jews, you see, were afraid, and they surrounded hemorrhages with all sorts of taboos and laws. Because you see, the law was that the life was in the blood, and the blood belongs to God. That's why Jews today, you see, won't eat ordinary meat from a butcher's. They go to kosher, K-O-S-H-E-R, they go to kosher butchers, where the animals have been killed in a certain way and bled in a certain way, so that there's no blood in the meat. Actually, it's rather nice. Kosher meat's very tasty. If you stay in a kosher hotel in Palestine, really is lovely. Lovely food. But you see, they eat this meat. They won't eat blood, because the law of God said that the blood belongs to God, because the life is in the blood. Actually, if you read the sacrifices in Leviticus, two bits of the sacrifice belong to Jehovah. Nobody could touch them. First of all, the blood, and the fat. The fat of the animal was sacred. It could not be eaten. Taboos, worth reading actually in Leviticus chapter 15. Hope you're not squeamish about these things. But lots of chapters about medicine and how to be clean and how to stay healthy in the book of Leviticus. Leviticus 15. And verse 1, you see the same rule applied for men. And the feeling is here, Leviticus 15 and verse 1, that the discharge is some kind of hemorrhage, maybe a bowel thing, a rectal hemorrhage, that they couldn't understand. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, say to the people of Israel, when any man has a discharge, presumably of blood, from his body, his discharge is unclean. And this is the law of his uncleanness for a discharge, whether his body runs with his discharge, or his body is stopped from discharge, it is uncleanness in him. Every bed in which he who has the discharge lies shall be unclean. Don't be squeamish now. And everything on which he sits shall be unclean. And anyone who touches his bed shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. You see how obsessive they are. It's almost an obsession. And whoever sits on anything on which he who has the discharge has sat shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. You're contaminated, you see, because you're dealing with an outcast from the congregation of God. And whoever touches the body of him who has the discharge, my, you can't be too careful living in such a society. You see how unclean he is? You can't touch him. He's set apart like a leper. Whoever touches the body of him who has the discharge shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. And if he who has the discharge spits on one who is clean. Then he shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. How obsessive, you see. And any saddle on which he who has the discharge rides shall be unclean, and whoever touches anything that was under him shall be unclean until the evening. And he who carries such a thing shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. Anyone whom he that has the discharge touches without having rinsed his hands in water shall wash his clothes and bathe himself in water and be unclean until the evening. See the word unclean, 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 untouchable, outside the congregation. And the earthen vessel which he who has the discharge touches shall be broken, and every vessel of wood, more expensive, shall be rinsed in water. And when he who hath a discharge is cleansed of his discharge, when the bleeding stops, then he shall count for himself 7 days for his cleansing, and wash his clothes, shall bathe his body in running water, and shall be clean. And on the 8th day, then he goes to the priest and makes atonement for his past. Now that's the law for the man, and it's the same rule for the woman. Verse 25, and this is where the lady with the hemorrhage comes in. Verse 25, if a woman has a discharge of blood for many days, not at the time of her impurity, that's to say when she's had a child, or if she has a discharge beyond the time of her impurity, all the days of the discharge, this is a running blood, a hemorrhage, an unnatural thing, all the days of the discharge she shall continue in uncleanness. Now this is the wifey, you see. As in the days of her impurity, she shall be unclean all the time. Every bed in which she lies, all the days of her discharge, shall be to her as the bed of her impurity, and everything on which she sits shall be unclean, as in the uncleanness of her impurity. Whoever touches these things, you see the taboos, shall be unclean, must wash his clothes in water, and bathe himself in water, and be unclean until the evening. But if she is cleansed of her discharge, she shall count for herself 7 days, and after that she shall be clean. Now that's why the wifey was going round the doctors, you see. If only she could get a doctor who would stop the blood, then she would count the days and take her offering and go to the priest, and the past would be atoned for, and she would be clean again, and she could come back to church, which is what she wanted to do. That was the end of the road, you see. Get back to the congregation of the saints. 29. And on the 8th day she shall take 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons, bring them to the priest to the door of the tent of meeting, and the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. Beg your pardon, I've lost the place, I've forgotten my glasses. And the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering, and the priest shall make atonement for her, atonement for her before the Lord for her unclean discharge. This is why, thus you shall keep the people of Israel separate from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness by defiling my tabernacle that is in the midst. Now you see what's happening. Jesus is on his way to do something tremendously important. He's about to have his first encounter with the kingdom of death. Now you see, according to the Gospels, Jesus raised the dead only 3 times. Perhaps there were other occurrences that we don't read of. But only 3 times do you read of Jesus speaking to a corpse? And this is the first time. Now, this was an occasion of major significance in the life of Jesus Christ. Actually, if you look at these three raisings of the dead, you'll see that Jesus each time is pushing further into the kingdom of death. This girl had just died. Next time it was the widow of Nain's son, and not only was he dead, but the funeral was on the way. They were on the way to the cemetery. He'd been dead a wee while. Next time was Lazarus, and he'd been dead for three days, was it? They said, you can't go into the sepulchre. He's been in there 3 days. It'd be a terrible smell. But Jesus goes in, and each time, you see, he's pushing further and further and further into the kingdom of death, because he has come to challenge the kingdom of death. You see, in his own death, he challenged the kingdom of death, because he died sinlessly. That was brand new. You see, only a sinless man could go into that kingdom and actually go further than the kingdom. Peter says he went further than the kingdom of death. He went right down to hell. And down in hell, he stole the keys of the grave from the devil. Because since the beginning of the world, since the fall of man, Satan held the keys of that kingdom of death and of hell. That's why you read in the book of Revelation, sometimes we read these words at a Christian funeral. Jesus said, I am he that liveth and was dead, and behold, I am alive forevermore, and I have the keys of death and of hell. This is why the medieval church used to perform at Easter time plays about the harrowing of hell. Jesus Christ scouring the great kingdom of death, stealing the keys from the devil. Now you see, he's on his way to this momentous encounter. And then he says, who touched me? He could have moved on, couldn't he? He could have felt the virtue draining out of him. And inside here he would have said, my, somebody's touched me believingly. Oh well, a busy man, you know, must press on to the dead little Galilee. But he didn't. Busy man, great man, on the way to this tremendous engagement, this very important appointment. And he turned round and he said, wasting time, who touched me? You know, the care of Jesus Christ is almost frightening in its personalness. It's so individually tailored for you and nobody else, for you and nobody else, that it's almost frightening. Jesus, you see, never comes to you and say, well, here's a blessing, goodbye. He says, who touched me? Oh, you, what's your name, wifey? Where'd you come from? What's been wrong with you? You see, it's the mark of a great man that he's not too busy to care for people. It is a mark of true greatness that it cares for people and has time for people. Let me tell you two stories from our own royal family. Old Queen Mary, a Christian woman, It was she who taught her son George the Sixth the gospel. This is why George the Sixth used to go to the Brethren meetings in Glasgow, in London, Plymouth Brethren. What they used to do was they would wait until the Brethren meeting had started, because it would be awful if the head of the Church of England had been seen going to a Brethren meeting. And then when the first hymn would get underway, the royal car would appear, and George would slip in the back seat and listen to the service, listen to the gospel, and just before it finished, he would slip out and the royal car would whisk him away to Buckingham Palace. Where did he learn that from? He learned it from his mother, old Queen Mary. She was a bit of a dragon. She was a Christian dragon. There are Christian dragons, you know. And we've got to live with them in heaven forever. But we'll all be changed, including ourselves. Queen Mary went to a large Christian meeting in London, and she asked to meet the preacher. It was an evangelical meeting. So the preacher was very embarrassed, you know. However, they were introduced, and he just stood like a dummy, because she was a formidable woman. Seen her, the toque, you know, the big toque, and a face that almost looked as if it had been lacquered on, you know, a very stern face, the Windsor jaw, and all those pearls, masses of pearls. And she said to the preacher, "Why are you so quiet?" And he said, "Well, excuse me, ma'am, but I don't know how to speak to a queen." And she said, "You speak to a queen like you would speak to any other woman in this hall." So he turned to her and said, "In that case, ma'am, are you born again?" And Mary said, "My man, it's many years since I came to know Jesus Christ, and I was greatly blessed by a little booklet called Safety, Certainty, and Enjoyment." Now, if you've been in Christian circles for years, you'll know that that's a tract that has stood the test of time. Oh, mercy, I think it goes way back to Victoria's day. But it's still worth reading, although I think it ought to be maybe revised and made a bit more contemporary. But it's a very telling little tract, and I often use it. I order a dozen at a time and hand them out to people who are interested. Safety, Certainty, and Enjoyment. And Queen Mary used to go around giving out that tract in specially chosen places. Now, you see, it would have been so easy for her just to brush aside the preacher and be too busy. But it's a mark of greatness that it cares for people. Here's another instance. In Canada, 1939, there was a big royal tour of Canada just before the outbreak of the Second World War. And George the Sixth and Elizabeth, now the Queen Mother, were on the royal tour of Canada. And they were in a crowded gathering, and this Christian fellow, greatly daring, went up to the Queen and said, "Excuse me, ma'am, can I ask you, do you know Christ as your personal Savior?" And without batting an eyelid, she said, "Many people know about God, and many people know about Christ, but I know him." And George said, "And I know him too." Now, it would have been so easy, you see, for her to turn round, give a nod to George, and on they would move. You know, busy, 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 next appointment, lunch, speeches, welcomes, grovelings. that she spent her time. Real greatness cares. It's the mark of God, you see. Peter, casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. Time for others. If anything is needed in Christian circles today, time for others. Time to spare. We have bred a race of executive Christians who expect other people to do the caring. You know, we crack the whips and we run the committee meetings and other people do the work. We just sit on the committees and get other people to do the work. It's not right. You see, God doesn't do this. There are no committees in heaven. Jesus never was at a committee meeting in his life. Never, never. He cared. And that is the mark of greatness. I want you to see it in Isaiah. This great chapter, it's one of my favorite chapters in Isaiah, 54. Here's care for you. Remember, Isaiah is speaking here. God is speaking here to a people who really had rejected him. 40 years in the wilderness, didn't want Jehovah. Then the judges came, didn't want the judges. Then the kings came, what a mess they made. David and all his boobs, and then Solomon and all his boobs, and then Rehoboam and all the mistakes he made. And so it went on until God said, you know, I am sick of this people. I will send you to Babylon for 70 years and teach you a lesson. Is that the end of the story? Look at verse 7 of Isaiah 54. I love these words. For a brief moment I forsook you, but with great compassion I will gather you. In overflowing wrath, for a moment I hid my face from you, but with everlasting love I will have compassion on you, says the Lord your Redeemer. Verse 9, how sure is this care? For this is like the days of Noah to me, as I swore that the waters of Noah should no more go over the earth. God has sworn that he'll never drown us again. He's going to burn us. He's going to burn the world, but he'll never drown it again. That's a promise from God, although you may not have thought so watching the weather the past 2 days, but he has promised that we'll never go under a flood again. Next time it's fire. As I swore that the waters of Noah should no more go over the earth, so I have sworn that I will not be angry with you, and I will not rebuke you. It's all finished. This verse, didn't Mendelssohn use this in Elijah? For the mountains may depart, and the hills be removed, but my steadfast love shall not depart from you, and my covenant of peace shall not be removed, says the Lord, who has compassion on you. What a verse. 11. O afflicted one, storm-tossed and not comforted, behold, I will set your foundation stones in antimony and lay your foundations with sapphires. What a house! Of course, this is all picked up by John in Revelation. It's the New Jerusalem. I will make your pinnacles of agate, your gates of carbuncles, and all your wall of precious stones. All your sons shall be taught by the Lord, and great shall be the prosperity of your sons. That's care for you. In righteousness you shall be established. You shall be far from oppression, for you shall not fear, and from terror, for it shall not come near you. If anyone stirs up strife, it is not from me. Whoever stirs up strife with you shall fall because of you. Verse 17. No weapon that is fashioned against you shall prosper. Anyone who lays a finger on a Christian has God to deal with. Whoever touches a Christian touches the apple of God's eye. Christians are precious to God. No weapon that is fashioned against you shall prosper, and you shall confute every tongue that rises against you in judgment. This is the heritage of the servants of the Lord. And their vindication comes from me. It's a mark of greatness that it cares like this. And that care is available very simply. I like the wifey's theology. It's simple. Simple theology is always the best. I was reading of this afternoon the great Archibald Alexander, the principal of Princeton College in the United States. Great man. His books are still read, although he lived last century. His commentary on Isaiah has not been paralleled. It has not been equaled, and it's been on the go for 100 years. Wonderful stuff, wonderful scholarship. And he came to die, Alexander. And he was asked what the heart of his theology was. And he said, all my theology is reduced to this narrow compass. Christ Jesus came into the world to save sinners. It's simple theology that gets blessings from God. And the woman's theology could not have been more primitive. She said, if only I could touch him. St. Augustine said, many thronged, she touched. People have always thronged Christ. He has always been popular, sometimes more popular at other times than at other times. He's beginning to get a little bit more popular nowadays, especially amongst young people, milling around. People are always milling around Christ, bumping into Christ. But she touched him because she believed she'd fit. It was a touch of faith. The caring Christ mediates his blessing to a touch of faith. We were speaking this morning about John Bunyan and his book The Holy War, and how it's about the city of Mansoul, which has 5 gates. The most important gate is Ear Gate, and that's the gate that's open now. Because you hear me, don't you? Don't see anyone sleeping, so I assume that you hear me. Ear Gate, Emmanuel, is reaching Mansoul by this gate. Now, normally, that's the gate that's open. But when this takes place, Bruce, the man who was imprisoned in Inverness by James VI of Scotland, because Bruce disagreed with the Stuarts, preached in the Old High a series of communion sermons, and in the first communion sermon he said, this is not original, it's from Bruce, said, every Sunday, ear gate is open. But at the Lord's Supper, nose gate is open, because we smell the bread and wine. Mouth gate is open, because we taste Christ. Eye gate is open, because we see Christ. And feel gate is open, because we sense Christ. Now you see, you can't touch Christ today. Just as surely as the wifey touched Jesus Christ by faith. And this is where you touch Christ. The gates of man's soul are open. And so it's appropriate that I close with a verse from a psalm. Lift up your heads, O ye gates, that the King of glory may come in. And it is in that spirit that we come to the Lord's table.